The concept of rebuilding has different connotations depending on where in the world you're located. In Pakistan, 33 million people were severely affected by a massive flooding in 2022. In Syria, there's still no reconstruction strategy after 12 years of war. And in India, there are slums where the quality of life can get a huge boost with simple architectural tools. Meet a number of deeply inspiring architects who share their experiences from their home countries. How they make a difference and how they reflect on how architecture is a social tool that gives people more power in their own lives. My name is Lasse Solsunde. I've spent the first day of the UIA World Congress of Architects in Copenhagen to report on the concept of rebuilding for the organization Byens Netværk, an association that connects the Danish building industry. The organization is also the co-host of the Rebuilding Pavilion that you can hear more about in our second episode from the UIA World Congress. In this podcast, we focus on rebuilding in a more broad sense and with a global perspective. Meet Syrian Mara Al-Sabouni, Pakistani Yasmin Lari, Danish Ingeborg Hau, and we begin with Indian Bhavna Jaimini, who made the design and program of the Rebuilding Pavilion at the UIA World Congress of Architects, held in Copenhagen in early July 2023. Bhavna Jaimini from Mumbai is also an urban practitioner and a writer. She works as a community design agency as a lead for community development.
How have you been working with rebuilding? What is your own line of work that has sharpened also your own thinking?
So I am an architect and a writer. I work with marginalized communities in India. I don't know if you're familiar with India, but in India we have in our cities more than 30 to 40% of people live in informal settlements, in slums where they don't have access to proper drinking water. The roads are very poorly built. The electricity is bad. They don't have open public spaces. And the densities are massive, like their homes don't get sunlight, their homes don't get natural light. And I've been working with these communities to sort of rebuild their built environment in seeing how we can adapt these homes to bring in more sunlight, how we can create social spaces within these communities, because the Indian government look at it is that they would want to displace all of them. But we sort of, like where I work in, is just like that though there are problems in these neighborhoods, they are also legitimate neighborhoods where people live, where people have made a life. And how can we bring more dignity into these spaces by providing them the services instead of asking them to, okay, let's raise it all and put you 20 kilometers outside the city. So that's where my practice has been too. It's around working with marginalized communities to have them access their right to the city through using architecture and design, participatory planning.
And which city you work from?
I work in Mumbai in India, I'm part of this organization called Community Design Agency. We're a collective of architects, artists, engineers, social designers, social workers, and collectively we do this kind of work, but not just in Mumbai, but in different parts of the country as well.
And in your thinking, is it about empowering people to create their own homes or living spaces with a more deeper knowledge?
Yes. So, you know, in India, if you see like the rural India where still the 60-70% of the country lives, everybody build their own house. It's a knowledge everybody has. Nobody goes and hires an architect. Because they know that, you know, somebody would know something about. And how the traditional communities are like, they all pitch in. Like, you would know how to make a wall. I would know something about, especially in tribal communities in India, like, that the skill of building is inherently there in all communities. Now, what cities have done is that they have created these really convoluted bureaucratic systems of building and de-skill the people. So people have that knowledge, and what we are doing is that, okay, how do we bring that knowledge together? How do we also legitimize it? To give you an example, like, because concrete is such a universal material, there are multiple studies on it, because a lot of research, a lot of funding has gone into making that material what it is today. But the same is not true for a lot of natural materials. So people think that, okay, this material is not good, or it is unsafe, but that's not true. It's also like how we perceive it. And similarly, when you look at a material poorly, then you start linking it to the communities that use it. So, you know, it's a cycle of marginalizing people, of where they're living, what materials are they using. And that's why we're saying that, okay, communities know how they build. We just need to listen to them. We just need to work with them to find out. So that's what we do. We try to understand where communities are coming from, what are their living patterns, and that is something that takes a lot of time, because the morale is really down in communities, especially in a city like Mumbai, where you have to hustle a lot. Rents are so high. There are 12 people living in a 20 square meter house. So then how do we bring these people together and say that, okay, you know, a new reality is possible, and find ways to achieve that?
How do you motivate people who are hard to motivate?
Yes.
And often don't have the resources. How do you work with these obstacles?
And I'll give you an example. I work a lot with youth, especially, and I think youth is why youth, because a part of my practice is towards re-energizing social spaces, creating more public spaces, because on the whole, if you look at in Indian cities, the public spaces per capita is really low, and it's almost not there in communities where I work with. The one place called Govandi where I'm working in, it's going to be very hard for you to imagine, but imagine 5,000 people living on a land smaller than Bella Center. Like half of Bella Center is 5,000 people are living.
Yeah, it's like a city.
Yeah, it's like a city, and they have no spaces. Like there are no parks, there are no open spaces for people to, you know, go out, hang out with their friends. So part of my practice for the last 4 years, and, you know, working with youth and see, okay, can we reclaim space? And what I realized was that initially it was very difficult. They were very lethargic. They were interested, but there was this deep-seated lethargy that has set into this youth, also because of the pandemic. And then I realized that it's also a function. It's not just mental, it's also physical, because they're not getting any sunlight. So they're extremely vitamin D deficient, which is linked to, like, you know, your depression and how you're feeling about yourself. And then I'm just like, built environment can have such a deeper impact on who you are and how you perceive yourself. And these kids that I work with, they're like age between 15 to 22, is such a powerful example of, if we're not very careful about how we're building our cities, it can have lasting damage on generations. So,
but how do you solve the resource problem? You know, the fact that people don't have money to buy material, or the material that would enhance their living standards?
So what we are doing is we're trying to work with multiple funding resources. So, and we work with all kinds of partners, individual donors, the government, philanthropic organization, funding agencies. And in a sense, like, it has become slightly, like, earlier it was be like, oh, this is not our problem. But I think after the pandemic, people are realizing that, okay, we are not so segregated as we thought we were. Like a problem in a community can very quickly become our own problem. So it's a selfish way of thinking, but sometimes that's what you have to use to convince people that, you know, we have to work towards ensuring a minimum standard, which is like, I'm just Copenhagen, like, at least there is a certain level of minimum living standards that is for everybody, but in city where I work within Mumbai or other parts of that's not there, like you will see extreme wealth, like the second richest person comes from India. And then I'm telling you that they're on the other side and in the same city. The man lives in the same city where he lives in a 27-story high mansion. And just 10 kilometers away is this community where 30,000 people are living on a 5-hectare plot. We are a developing country, and a lot of times when we go to funders, and this funder would say that, you know, but I'm working on farmer suicides. I don't have time. Like, what you're doing is luxury work. Because you have, you know, on one hand, you have children dying. Your men committing suicide because we have a farmer crisis. And then when we are saying that, okay, but we want to improve living standards of communities, and that is also looked at as something slightly posh, though it's not. But if you compare it, like, and it also shouldn't be a apples to apple comparison. But sometimes it's looked at that, like, we have been told that this is, we don't want to do this because we have far more urgent humanitarian needs to fulfill in the society. And I think that has been a challenge so far. We're still struggling.
So you still have to justify your own cause, so to speak.
Absolutely. And we've also realized that just like we have to train the community, I feel like we also have to train the public partners. When we are like designing a house or designing a street, the first thing is that we do a design workshop with the people. And we have designed different kind of tools to help them, because sometimes we work with women who are not familiar with plans. They don't know how to read plans. But if they don't know, does that mean that they don't have a say? Like, because plans is just a tool, right? We can do something else. So we do things like using chalks and threads, things that they're familiar with. You know, in India, do rangolis. So we do like rice powder, and we make like plans with that. So a lot of like time goes into like making sure that how everybody has a voice. But as architects, we need to be equipped to understand that voice, and sometimes we don't do. So it's also a lot of unlearning that we also have to do.
Our second interview partner is the Syrian writer and architect Marwa Al-Sabouni. In 2016, her praise book, The Battle for a Home, The Vision of a Young Architect in Syria, came out. And in 2021, her second book, Building for a Hope, Towards an Architecture of Belonging, was published in English.
With the task in your country, I guess rebuilding must be priority number one, or should be in a way.
It should be, yes.
When we see all the damages, what kind of ideas are prevalent in the way you work also regarding rebuilding? Because I guess there are numerous challenges to be taken care of.
Well, the number one challenge is politics. And that's, I think, is true to all the architectural landscape across the world. But I mean, it is felt very badly in my own country, because believe it or not, after 12 years of conflict and destruction, we still don't have a rebuilding process and or a rebuilding initiative. And in my own work, in my books, I write about the role of architecture in conflicts, and I also describe the prevalent architectural approach, which is post-colonial. So in our case in Syria, we were affected by the French modernism, which came with the French occupation of Syria. And after the independence, those ideas of what is the architecture idea became, you know, the same models that actually destroyed the culture and architecture, and more importantly affected the communities and, you know, dismantled the Syrian community. And fortunately, if you kind of investigated what kind of mentality that is leading the way in pre-rebuilding now in Syria, you will find out that the Gulf model is the coveted model. So,
okay. Can you explain what the model contains? What is the core idea?
Yeah, of course. I mean, it's the skyscrapers, the tall buildings, the glass facades, the building for the elite, corporate building, and construction that is done, you know, via like a proxy construction when you import expertise from the outside and from the expert West, let's say, and we will have models that are foreign, alien, and they will land on our streets, and in that sense, people will be priced out, they will be pushed out, both physically and even psychologically.
And are there any attempts to rebuild a more traditional local architectural tradition?
And when I speak about the cons of the modern model, you know, the instant response is it will be the assumption that I'm advocating the traditional model, which I'm not doing that. I mean, I'm advocating the core values that brought that model into being, and to be embracing those values and to create the sense of continuity in creating a new model, but that is rooted with the values and then the principles and the culture of the place. Saying that, I also in my work make the case and explain how the city planning and the city authority had actually systematically destroyed the traditional buildings and erased, you know, whole chunks of the city in the name of modernization and the gentrification and all of that, which is happening unfortunately around the world, but with exceptions of, you know, protection of heritage. And something that I believe that, like I said in the beginning, we should be avoiding, making this binary distinction between what is past and obsolete, you know, and what is new and modern and futuristic. We should find the link in the values that created that idea.
So like a third way in to try to combine more traditional building methods or aesthetics?
It's The Battle for Home, the name of my first book, and it's this creating this sense of home, recreating neighborliness and bringing people together and re-embracing the aesthetics of our architecture that is not ready to be consumed, and it doesn't belong to the mass production line, but it's something that is relies on networks of workers and people and you know, bringing in many strands from the city that were involved basically in the traditional building, that enabled that traditional building. Yeah. Something better. Yeah.
And what is your own home city?
Homs.
Homs.
Yeah.
Homs. Hmm. How is it to, you still live in Homs?
Yeah, I've never left.
You never left?
Yeah.
How does it look like in Homs if you walk down the main streets?
Well, it's very schizophrenic to live in Syria, and not only in Homs. I mean, Homs is 60% mass destroyed. So you can imagine that, you know, it's like a Jekyll and Hyde kind of city. It has two faces, one that is completely wiped down, and one is like distorted, you know, bearing the scars of war, you know, like old building or partially collapsed or damaged buildings, with some streets where no signs of war are visible. But I think the painful reality about Syria is that you could go and visit and you will see people who are in cafes and restaurants or markets, and you would say, okay, well, nothing is going on. Although everything that is happening around the world, from, you know, from crisis with like the wealth crisis, and, you know, and the work crisis, and all the crises that people are protesting about in even in the best European cities now, are, you know, you could multiply that tens of times in Syria, and that is something that you do not necessarily see in the street, but you will definitely see in the faces of the people and in the inner life of the people, the constant strive to find a living in Syria.
Mm. Yeah. Mm. And can architecture change that in a way?
Well, I believe so. I believe that architecture was hugely responsible for transforming our built environment and our cities and our countrysides. And with that, it was able to create more segregated people, more segregated community, and to shred the cities that we had, into different groups and different conflicting groups. And it can be the bonding force again, and it can be, they can create a place where people can find hope, can find beauty, can find livelihood again. So it's not can architecture do it? I mean, architecture must do it. And I believe that we have the responsibility as architects and as legislators to find that way.
And do you see that people create ideas, building houses out of rubble, building something new out of the old?
Well, I can understand why you would ask such a question, because we are living at the hub for that creative thinking. And I know that my own country has many great minds and many potential energy for creating this, and the history of Syria, attest to that. But unfortunately, when you create a situation where you are in a survival mode, the first thing a young man or woman will think about after they finish school is which country they should migrate to.
So in that perspective, where do you put your hope when you are in an environment where so many people are not willing or able to participate?
For example, I taught at the university, and all my students, without an exception, they were just, seeking education for the sake of leaving. So I could say 100% of the students wasn't interested in ideas, but they are interested in them as a vehicle to leave. I mean, who can blame them? Again, it's just very difficult, like you said, to hold on hope. But in my case, I rely on my faith. So I think that I do believe that everything is the hands of our Creator, and I believe that we are, as human beings, are there for a task, for something, and your task maybe could be just to be patient and to continue what you can do until a moment of sunshine comes out. Yeah. And I hope sunshine comes out.
Our third interview partner at the Rebuilding Pavilion is a highly regarded Pakistani architect, Yasmin Lahri, also a keynote speaker at the Congress in Copenhagen. Ms. Lahri recently received the Royal Gold Medal from the Royal Institute of British Architects. In her home country, she has founded the Heritage Foundation Pakistan, an NGO that helps locals building houses from locally sourced material.
First of all, that we need to collaborate now with each other to face all these difficult situations which are everywhere, where there's poverty, there's disparities, there's a climate change effect on all kinds of situations, but also the disasters that it brings with it. And unless we collaborate with each other, we have a participatory approach, we won't be able to handle it. And of course, the world is very different. I work in the global south. We are right now in the global north, where there's probably no dearth of material, but the fact that you are becoming so conscious of how to conserve is a very good thing, because all of us have to now save the planet. And unless we conserve by rebuilding, by reusing, by applying the principles of circular economy, and in my case, I work with communities to give them strength so that they become self-reliant. Because we can no longer just say, okay, we'll take things, we'll live on charity. That's the worst thing you can do to people. So my motto is, first of all, zero carbon, zero waste, zero donor. So that there's nobody needs to do anything. It's a community that will do it itself, and that leads to zero poverty. So, and I have another three three no's also. One is to say no to charity, no to cement, and no to steel. I need to get to zero carbon, and I need to have self-reliance. So I have this issue where last year 33 million people were displaced because of the floods that happened. That translates into at least 3 to 4 million households. It's a huge number. They say that it's 1.2 billion people that are really kind of have inadequate shelter, but they're at least, you know, half of that are the ones that have no shelter at all. And so that should be our target. I mean, we need to have people living a decent life. And I think that architects must now be in the forefront of all that. Because we have this strong power of design. And the poor need more design than the rich, I think. So far, we've concentrated on giving the rich everything they wanted. In terms of beautiful structures, iconic buildings, to impress everybody. But
Steel and glass.
Steel and glass, but in the process, carbon footprints are very high. Architects and people who are working in the built environment are responsible for 40% of all emissions. Cement and steel alone are huge contributors to pollution. So why are we using them? So that's why it's wonderful to see the work done by the Danish Academy, by the amazing use of wood and all kinds of natural materials, and to see these young people from different parts of the world joining hands together to build it all themselves. It's not done by anybody else. The other ones who've been, you know, looking at the plumb line, they're looking at whether everything is squared up, they're the ones who are bolting and cutting and everything. So I think it's very reassuring. And the youth are the ones who will take us, they'll find the right solutions for us.
Taking your own country's experience with the flooding, this massive flooding, and the ideas that are needed, is it also the architect's task to produce idea and give this away to people so they can power themselves?
Oh, absolutely. I believe that architects have abdicated the responsibility more or less, most of the time, by not being in the front of all that work, because when we look at Global South and we look at Sub-Saharan Africa or look at, you know, South Asia, there are more of the ones who have nothing than the ones who have a lot. So I think that architects, at least I feel very much, very strongly myself also, that we need to be out there to find solutions and to work with people. So I believe in co-design and co-creation. I work with communities. I see that what I need is that everybody must have the tools to be able to build a strong structure so that they are not displaced. In my country, there are no toilets. So I need dignity for women. We can't have that going on. So if I teach them how to build, they can carry on doing it. And that's what I'm doing now. Or if I can get them water so that teach them how they can have access to water, then they can save and they can do it. And I have, which has now become very famous, is my cooking stove, which is an earthen platform and a stove made out of earth, which women do themselves. And to date, about 130,000 have been built by housewives themselves. It's very low cost. So my participatory approach results in really, really inexpensive ways of doing things. And so we can scale up to any number that you want. And if we talk of incremental building, like you teach them how to do one room, but then they can make many more themselves. And also, I believe in what I call a barefoot ecosystem. It's all about poor and the poverty. And within that, if we can teach them or give them the skills to be able to produce or make products, which I call barefoot products or barefoot entrepreneurs, then they can sell to everybody all around them. And they all make money. So my barefoot entrepreneurs, at least two have become millionaires, and I'm hoping there'll be many more coming up. women are in the lead. I'm putting them deliberately in the lead because I want dignity for my women. I want them to be respected. I want people to understand that they have skills which other people do not have. So, in a sense, I feel architecture can be used to provide agency, to provide voice to people who don't have a voice today. I think architecture is to be used as a tool to elevate the status of women and also empower them, to all communities, I mean, the poorest, to know that they can do it themselves. So it's all about food security, it's all about flood mitigation measures, it's all about building safe structures, livelihoods, everything.
In that way, being an architect in your part of the world is more like being a social engineer instead of someone who is preoccupied with aesthetics.
Oh, aesthetics play a very important role, but mine is called barefoot social architecture, not engineering, but it is like social engineering. It has different tenets, and if you follow them, we are getting there. And you need aesthetics to play a very important role in the whole thing. I keep on saying this, when the resources are scarce, you need really the best designers in the world to be there. Because aesthetics is the key to better living. And it's not the preserve of only the rich. The poor also deserve it. And as architects, we have to be there to make sure that they get the best possible design for them to be able to live in. And you would be surprised if you see how then they innovate. My women are doing amazing creative work because I use only lime and earth and bamboo, and that's all. No industrial materials, nothing brought from outside. Everything locally sourced and everything done by them themselves. So we'll get there. I'm still a little bit far, but I'm hoping by the end of this year, I want to reach about 400,000 families. I think we will have them surviving quite well, fending for themselves. But then I'll scale up next year. Hopefully, by the end of next year, I should reach 1 million households by people themselves, even if nobody comes to help.
And how you teach people, because it also seems to be a big educational project that you are working on.
Yes, I feel that we've not given enough credence to people who might be non-literate, but they have another kind of literacy. They have a very good sixth sense about learning because they want to improve their life. So they're highly motivated. And so we are training a huge number of people who are from the same area, have gone through the same difficulty, and now know how to do these things. So we run special programs for them. And I think in the last, it's been about 6-7 months, I think we must have trained about 500 to 600 of these people. And they are fanning out in different areas, in different villages. So every month since April, we are starting 2 brigades, each one of about 24 people each. You add on every month 2 more. They cover 100 villages minimum, that is about 6,000 families, and they charge a very small amount of money. And so this whole thing about how do you build better is being passed on. And technology plays a very important role for us, because now everybody's got Wi-Fi, they've got WhatsApp, so we get all the pictures all the time, so we can judge and control, and not control so much as trying to see how it is. And it works pretty well.
So you also do like online counseling in a way?
Yes, all the time. It's a wonderful experience, very rewarding. I love it. Mm. And I've retired from architecture. I don't build for the rich anymore at all. Mm. So I can devote my time to this.
And do you expect states, communities, district governments, does it take their support to get the ideas flourish even more, or do you think it can work on a more NGO kind of level?
You know, I've in countries like mine, normally governance is very lax. Normally, they go in for arrangements which are easy for them. So if the World Bank comes in with a few million dollars of help, of loan, they will put up some structures, but I believe so far maybe not more than 300 have been built so far, and I'm into quite a few more. So I think the communities can do it themselves. Thank you very much. then there are no intermediaries. I don't take any money from anybody. I say if you want to help, it must go directly to my women's committees. So that way we cut out everything in the middle. And so we accept the help, but my communities do that. I don't have to do it. And we are very happy to take things in kind, because money is very corrupting in my country, or most countries like mine. So it's better if everything comes to us in kind. So I think it's a wonderful thing. The theme is amazing of this conference. And it's good that we are focusing on the Sustainable Development Goals, because many countries lag behind in that. And most of all, if architects learn to lower the carbon footprint in everything that they do, that's what we need now. So that means alternative materials, on which you're doing all this research here. It's going on. Wonderful. And we need to just spread all this.
And do you see younger generations of architects also, taking these positions, going away from steel and glass, and having a more social conscience when they build?
I think the young people are much more conscious. I mean, this is what I'm hearing. I'm hearing it all the time. But then they ask me, they say, we want to do this, but how do we do it? So I feel that universities, I think all the institutions like the International Union of Architects, the Royal Institute of British Architects, the Commonwealth Association of Architects must now come forward. And now they should create a partnership between the universities themselves and the corporate sector, or the building product sector, so that we do something called architectural incubators. If we can establish that in many universities in the world, then a lot of young people will do the right thing, which is what they want to do, but they don't get the support. So I wish somehow that my voice is heard. You know, I've seen this all over the world. Money is never the issue. There's enough money everywhere. It's only that we need to make sure it is used properly, that's all. And if we could do that and give these young designers a chance, but I want architects to be in the forefront of all this. They will be the best ones. They will do the best service to communities. And the world needs it. So if somehow all of us join hands together, the senior professionals, everybody, I think we could do a lot of good. Otherwise, 2030 is going to be very elusive. You know, it's only a target, but I don't know. I don't see how we'll make it unless we really change everything drastically.
Last question. Is this a big step away from modernist thinking and embracing traditional methods in a new way?
Absolutely. I work in conservation. I've been a great one for working on heritage. I've saved many buildings in my own country, and I've learned so much from there. I've learned so many techniques. I've learned so many forms that were used that were stable, that withstood many of the disasters. There's a whole learning that needs to be done, what we call from ancient wisdom, that exists. And it exists everywhere, because you have your own medieval cities also, which can teach us a lot about humanism, about how do you work with each other, how do you care for people rather than for vehicles and for other kind of things. Very different from the capitalist system, which is all for profit. Because what we do need is a different world. And COVID has taught us that something like that doesn't distinguish between rich and the poor. You live in a palace or in a makeshift shack. COVID doesn't discriminate. So why do we discriminate? Why aren't all our environments conducive to good health for everybody? Why aren't we looking at the planet and seeing what are we leaving for the next generation? And so there's much to do, but we have to curb our consumption. We have to make sure that we think of others before we think of ourselves.
Needs a lot of humbleness, both for architecture and for everyone else.
I think we need to learn that, yes, yes.
Our final interview partner is Ingeborg Hau, who besides being an architect, is also the curator of the Rebuilding Pavilion at the World Congress in Copenhagen, a project we describe thoroughly in our other podcast, Rebuilding for Hope.
So if we look at cities, we are kind of practically rebuilding all the time. We have economical changes, we have new housing techniques, we have expansion of cities. So why having a special focus on rebuilding?
So I think you're absolutely right. We rebuild all the time. But I don't think we think about it as rebuilding, even though that's actually what we are doing. Rebuilding has a connotation of being specifically linked to war or to natural disasters, which is something that I think, at least in Denmark, we are not necessarily linking to our own way of developing our built environments. But that's exactly the point of this project, that rebuilding is a common challenge that we all work with. Some, of course, face a very different sense of urgency, a very different type of challenge than we do normally where I'm from in Copenhagen. And I think we can learn from each other, even though the challenge of rebuilding is very different, also very different in terms of severity, depending on where we are locally working from. But we can learn from each other even so. Even though the drama is different, even though the challenge is different, and even though the local sense of urgency is different, there are still some similar strategies that we can work with, and we can learn from each other's solution strategies.
So, of course, rebuilding is a discipline. Climate change is wars, you mentioned it. How would you separate it? Because let's take war rebuilding. How does this task, how do you say, differ from other kinds of rebuilding processes?
So I think in terms of war, of course, it's a different challenge because you are being attacked. You are under attack and you have to rebuild also while you are still under attack or you are in the middle of conflict. Of course, in Sudan or in Ukraine or in areas of conflict, you have this unsafe reality that you have to find a way to navigate within. You have to rebuild while this situation is still occurring. That is different from, for instance, being hit by a flood or a tsunami or a natural disaster that is more isolated. So you have to be in a state of distress while you rebuild. And I think that's very different from other situations. It's different in terms of building, but it is especially mentally different for the people that are affected. Because you also have to be in a state that you can't control, where you feel unsafe, you feel, of course, threatened. And you still have to find a state of mind where you are able to think about the future, even though the future is very uncertain. And not only that, you also have to find a state of being able to think about a long-term future. So the stakes are higher, you could say.
Rebuilding is also sometimes skipping traditions, reinventing, maybe creating even better environments than the one that has been destroyed. So are there any examples that comes to your mind regarding this?
We also work at the Academy, we work with innovation, and there is this term called wartime innovations, where you could say that you have a lot, for instance, now in terms of sustainable development, we have a lot of solutions that we want to implement in the way we build today. But it's difficult because the market runs with traditional materials or methods. But then when you have all of a sudden a big building challenge like the rebuilding, you get this situation where you can actually push forward new products very quickly. We saw it after World War II, where concrete and steel and all of these big suburban settlements really took off. Even though the materials were invented many years before, the momentum happened after the war because all of Europe needed to be rebuilt. You could say that the situation in Ukraine or other conflict areas is similar. And hopefully it will result in a boost in sustainable materials and techniques for rebuilding. But that is difficult, of course, to foresee now. And I think on the agenda of, for instance, the Ukrainians, that is not top of mind. Top of mind is to solve problems of people being displaced, of lack of housing, lack of infrastructure. Some of the Ukrainian cities are wiped out. It's difficult to have that conversation with people being affected, but it's important. As their friends and neighbors, to insist on having that conversation and to keep offering new solutions. I think that's everyone's responsibility, not only the society's hit.
And will sustainability be a new bottom line in the way that cities will be rebuilt?
Hopefully. The challenge is, and that's why one of the reasons rebuilding is sustainable rebuilding is interesting for everyone working with the in the building industry. Because the challenge is to rebuild fast, but do it in a long-term perspective. And that is always a challenge when talking about sustainability, is meeting the needs of the current generations while protecting the future generations' ability to meet their needs. It's the same in rebuilding, but it's more urgent. So it's sort of it's like an extreme situation of making sustainable choices.
Also, how do you see the background for a lot of future rebuilding would be flooding, cyclones, drought, all kinds of natural phenomena that will expand to the extremes, meaning also that cities need to be rebuilt maybe with a new shell, so to speak, with a new ability to breathe or to transport water. So do you also see that that we need to be more maybe drastic in our thinking? Because future climate will be more extreme, so we need to be a little bit more extreme in our way of thinking.
Yeah, or maybe we need to be less controlled or in less in control. I think European cities are, Copenhagen also, are an example of trying to control the landscape and the climate. We've built in a way that we've put the water underground in tubes. We've evened out the topography of the landscape that we've settled on. And now we find that that's not necessarily a sustainable strategy. But when we look at, for instance, some of our collaborators from Bangladesh, who are used to very extreme water conditions and floods every year, or our friends in India who have a monsoon hitting them, they know this, so they built in a way that can adapt to these climate and weather situations. And that means that they are more resilient, I think, in their way of thinking, in their way of settling. They also have, some of them, at least some of the projects that I've seen in from Bangladesh, have also a different vision for life cycles. Like at home, we think that the longer a building stands, the more sustainable it is. It is also in the word sustain. But I don't think that's necessarily true in other cultures. You have more temporary structures. You have materials that may not have a very long lifespan. You can combine them with other materials that do, and then you can switch them out once they are not holding the same abilities that they did when you constructed. And that's a different way of thinking about sustainability, I think.
Also accepting that shorelines will change, climate will change.
Yeah, and I think like it is becoming apparent for everyone that, that we as humans can't control the climate or the nature. It's so much stronger than we are, and I think that's a new way of seeing ourselves in a global ecosystem, that we are not in control like we used to think we were, and that means that we have to adapt to nature and maybe not the other way around.
Is there also like a social, how do you say, clash here? Because we live in a city here, Copenhagen. We're about to build a new part of the city that also will work as a flood protection mechanism, because we can do it. We're rich, but a lot of people don't have the means. They don't have the money, yeah. And a lot of cities are expanding without control. How do we meet that a lot of poor people will get more affected by climate changes and will have more need of relocation, rebuilding?
I think that's one of the biggest reasons why it's important to talk about rebuilding as a common challenge, because you're absolutely right. We've spent so much energy and so many resources in developing our way of living and our cities. And other people are paying the price for it in different places in the world. And we often talk about these challenges as if what we can do to help is give money or aid to areas in need. And that's, of course, true. And that's also a big part of our responsibility. But we can also learn from these people that have learned to adapt to nature, for instance. So we could also argue that instead of expanding our cities, we could invite people from around the world that have managed to stay in their cities and or stay in their areas of their living areas and adapt to the challenges that nature are facing. And we could expand our cities in different ways. We could live more people per square meter. I mean, in Denmark, we have the biggest, I think, area of housing space per person. And that is, of course, a very unsustainable way of living. So if we moved closer together, we wouldn't have the same need to expand our cities or the area that our city occupies.
Here we end this podcast, Strategies. Here we end this podcast, Reflections of Rebuilding, a Global Journey. You listen to Ingeborg Hau from Denmark, Bhavna Jamini from India, Syrian Mara Al-Sabuni, and Pakistani Lasmin Yari. My name is Lasse Sorsunde. I interviewed and produced this podcast for Byens Netværk, an association that connects the Danish building industry. Senior project manager at Byens Netværk, Nana Yardov, has set up and planned this episode. And thank you for listening.